Ryan Seacrest here. So every great barbecue takes a little patience. And while the food does its thing, you can enjoy a little Chumba Casino. The perfect recipe. Chumba Casino. Always good to have you back.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage, segment number 5 of the trial coverage for today, the 9th of February, 2023. Let's take you right to the courtroom.
Rise and come to order.
That wouldn't be heard outside the jury's presence.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Hey, please, the court. This is something
new that has come up, Your Honor. I'm sure Your Honor recalls the testimony of Shelley Smith this Monday. And her testimony was, let's say, somewhat malleable. We've discovered late last night that a GoFundMe page was set up for Ms. Smith, soliciting donations until the wording was changed during the testimony of the last witness. It read that my mother was caretaker for Alec Murdaugh's mom. She recently had to testify against him and goes on to say, I want to reward her for her bravery and honesty. The very first donation made on this GoFundMe page, which was made shortly after it first went up last night, was made by attorney Mark Tinsley, who paid her $1,000, presumably following the description of this in consideration of her testimony. And Your Honor, I have, if you want, printouts of the screenshot showing that. Shortly after Mark Tinsley's name actually appeared as the donor for $1,000, he removed his name and it now appears as anonymous, but I'm told the Attorney General has confirmed with Mr. Tinsley that he admits he did make this payment to the witness in the middle of trial, who is still under subpoena.
And therefore?
Your Honor, and therefore, the defense would move to exclude his testimony. And
on what basis?
Your Honor, the legal standard here is difficult to find. I cannot, searching Westlaw, find a single case in which a prosecutor has put tries to put to the jury a lawyer who has already testified he has a direct financial interest in the outcome of this case, who is also making monetary payments to prosecution witnesses during the trial. Your Honor, I believe that this is a question of first impression. And because it's a question, I understand that the facts here in this case are disturbing, but because it's a question of first impression, I would respectfully urge the court to keep in mind the aphorism that bad facts make bad law. You know, a prosecutor, to my knowledge, to Westlaw's knowledge, has never before done this.
What's improper about what he did?
About what Mr. Tinsley did?
Yes.
He made a financial payment to a witness in the middle of a trial that he has a financial interest in the outcome of. He has testified. Who is under subpoena. She's still under subpoena. He made a $1,000 payment as a reward for her honesty testifying in a matter that he has testified that he has a direct financial interest in.
Well, that would be good fodder for cross-examination.
Well, Your Honor, I respect the court's ruling.
I'm not going to strike his testimony. It may be good fodder for cross-examination.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes.
One other issue, given the testimony in the in-camera proceedings, we would ask that he be precluded from offering testimony about focus groups on the verdict for the Beach matter, speculation about fixing a jury in Hampton County. These matters don't go to the motive purpose that his testimony is being offered for and would be prejudicial.
Well, I'm loath to attempt to screen testimony in advance. Lawyers ask questions, lawyers object, and judges rule. So you've sounded a warning to the state that you object to that testimony, and if such a question is asked and an objection is made, then I will rule on the objection.
Yes, Your Honor.
Anything else?
From the state, Your Honor.
The jury is present, sir.
Okay, cross-examination.
Please, the court.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Malinowski.
Mr. Griffin.
The $750,000 loan that was made in July of 2021, that was approved by three members of the executive committee, was it not?
Yes, sir.
And the three members that approved that loan were Mr. Charlie Lafitte, Mr. Russell Lafitte, and Ms. Gray Henderson, is that correct?
That's correct.
And Mr. Charlie Lafitte, chairman of the board of the Palmetto State Bank at the time, is that right?
Yes, sir.
He's the largest shareholder of Palmetto State Bank?
Him individually, no.
He wasn't the largest individual?
No.
Did he own 30% of the bank?
Not individually, no.
Okay. And then his son was Russell Lafitte?
That's correct.
And his daughter was Gray Henderson?
Correct.
And it was his position that if Alec Murdoch wanted a loan from Palmetto State Bank, that the bank would loan him the money. Is that correct?
That was his opinion.
And Alec Murdoch was a member of PMPED law firm. You're aware of that at the time?
Yes, sir.
And PMPED law firm was one of the most, largest customers of the bank.
It was a large customer of the bank.
And the partners in the firm all had banking relationships with the bank, correct?
I'm aware that many did, yes.
And oftentimes when members of the law firm had clients who needed to borrow money before they got recoveries in their case, the partners from the firm would send them to the bank and the bank would loan money on future recoveries. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I am.
And so the firm was good business for the bank.
It was a good customer.
And the bank, in turn, provided good services to the members of the firm.
Yes, sir.
And if it meant, getting a loan in a rush without having all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, I mean, that would happen. Isn't that right?
Not to that magnitude, no.
Well, it certainly happened with Mr. Alec Murdoch in July of 2021, right?
Yeah, I believe in August of 2021.
Well, the loan was made, the money was provided to Mr. Alec Murdoch in July of 2021, right?
$350,000 was provided in with that wire transfer by subsequently in knowledge of.
And the documentation was essentially loan not on the books, or what's the acronym?
Loans not on system, LNOS.
Right. But it's a loan, it's just not on the system.
It's an advance from a general ledger account.
To be documented as a loan down the road.
One would hope, yes, sir.
And that's what happened here?
Eventually.
In August.
In August.
Now, Alec didn't work for the bank, did he?
No, sir.
He didn't represent the bank, did he?
To my knowledge, no.
He was just a good customer of the bank, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And the bank treated him like a good customer because that was in the bank's interest?
Yes, sir.
Now, you said something on direct that I want to follow up on. And my notes say that after the tragic murder of Maggie and Paul, that the bank undertook a loan review of Alex's loans. Is that right?
In response to the August 9th email, yes, sir.
Well, the August 9th email was triggered because of Maggie and Paul's murders?
That and other information, yes, sir.
Okay, and what other information?
I think Mr. Norris Lafitte had asked some questions or had conversations with individuals and wanted to know the full accounting of the bank's relationship.
Okay. And one of the factors that Mr. Norris Lafitte included was he had just lost his wife and son, and let's take a look at it, at his standing with the bank, loans outstanding, et cetera.
I think that's a fair statement, yes, sir.
Okay. Up until June 7th, 2021, the bank was not examining Alex's loans, were they?
We're not scrutinizing them, no, sir.
Yeah. He did he and Maggie had a loan review from the bank, whether they knew it or not, back in July 10th of 2020, correct?
Yes, sir.
And I'm going to show you Defendant's Exhibit 91 and ask if this is the loan review that was done, documented to the Executive Committee on July 10th, 2020.
Yes, this is a copy of a loan review prepared by Gray Henderson, the relationship summary of Alex Murdoch and Maggie Murdoch.
Thank you. And what's the date?
2020.
July 2020. Your Honor, I would move exhibit, defendant's exhibit 91 in evidence at this time.
No question, Your Honor.
It's admitted.
Put the front page up there. And so Doug, go down so we can see the, keep going, there you go. So to the Executive Committee on July 10th, 2020, who was on the Executive Committee with the bank?
At that time, Charlie Lafitte, Russell Lafitte, Gray Henderson, myself, I believe Scott Swain was on it at that time.
And it's a five-member executive committee?
Yes, sir.
And I think you mentioned earlier that did it take the majority of the committee to approve loans over a certain amount?
Sitting in a meeting, yes, sir.
Excuse me?
In a meeting, yes, sir.
Okay. And Gray Henderson is preparing this loan review for Alex Murdoch, right?
Yes, sir.
It says Richard Alexander Alex Murdoch is a lifetime resident of Hampton County. He and his wife, Margaret B. Maggie, recently sold their home in Hampton and moved their permanent residence to their farm in Islington. Alex is a respected partner with Peters Murdoch Parker Ellsworth and Dietrich Law Firm. They are currently involved in a wrongful death suit involving their youngest son, Paul, in a boating accident. Civil case is still pending. So that was the background on this.
That was a general summary of current situation.
And then the reviewed financials related to their tax returns and whatnot. Is that correct?
She's just stating in there that what financial information we have on file.
Okay. And then you go through each outstanding loan, is that right?
It's a summary of the loan, yes, sir.
Okay, and the first loan is can you tell us what that is? Williams Island on St. Helena?
We had a loan, I believe that loan was a joint loan with a gentleman by the name of Barrett Bowler, secured by two or three little islands off St. Helena.
And that loan's in good standing? Says all payments?
All payments made as agreed. Yes, sir.
Okay. And now the next loan is a loan on, that's the Edisto Beach House. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And here it says that the home appraised for $440 in February of 2016. And current balance on the note was $206,000. This is in July of 2020. Is that right?
That's what it says. Yes, sir.
And it says they've been 30 days late three times. I think that's what it says.
Yes, sir.
I guess if you go over 30 days on your loan payment, that's a strike against you when the...
It gets noticed.
It gets noticed. But that house at Edisto, the bank had a mortgage on it dating back at least for some time, right?
Yes, sir.
And you know it recently sold,
yes,
that
sir.
House. And do you know the sale price?
I think it was just below $1 million.
Okay. So the bank's pretty good, in a pretty good position here in July 2020 with $200,000 on what sold a couple of years later for $1 million, right?
Many years later, but yes.
How many years later?
Well, I think it occurred in 2022, and this is in 2020.
Okay. 2 years then?
To
go with that?
Yeah, I'll go with that.
Is too many?
In the real estate market, 2 years can, right, be a long time.
All right. Then the next loan is first mortgage on, I don't know what you're doing there, Doug. It's on 856 acres, and the second mortgage on 914 acres. That's the Moselle property, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And what's the outstanding balance of that loan?
$719,769.16.
And what kind of value do you have there?
Good value in it. If the appraisal is $3.3 million.
Now, you know, there's a contract on that property today?
I understand there is, yes.
You know what it is?
No, sir, I don't.
Okay. You know it's more than 3.3?
I don't know that.
Okay. Bank still has a mortgage on it?
We do.
Okay. You turn the page, Doug? If that's the last one on there. And here's another loan. And I guess that's part of the same... That's another track at Moselle with additional. Was that the same loan? Are we talking about a new loan here?
I believe we are. Yes.
Okay. And what is this?
This balance is $888,527.08.
Okay. And what's the value we have on this?
Assume it's the Moselle $3.3 million from the preceding loan.
Okay.
Two mortgages on the single property.
All right.
Or the acreages.
And then the conclusion here, the summary is Alec and Maggie Murdoch are longtime customers of Palmetto State Bank. They've had some late payments, but in my opinion, those are mainly due to Alex being hard to reach and set appointments to sign the paperwork. The majority of his payments are set up on an annual basis because the law firm makes their distributions in December. Now, let me ask you about that. Were you aware that a lot of the partners at the law firm who owe money to Palmetto State Bank just pay once a year because that's really when the bulk of their income is generated or received?
That's my understanding. That's correct.
And so this was not special just to Alec, but it's not, but other partners at the firm have the same payment plan.
You're setting up the repayment to coincide with the receipt of their income or the bulk of the income.
Sure. And it says the Murdochs have always paid their loans to the bank, and I do not see that changing. And it says, depending on the outcome of the pending lawsuit, they may have to liquidate some assets, but our loans are more than sufficiently collateralized. Meaning you've got plenty of security, is that right?
In 2020, yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Alec and Maggie have, to your knowledge, never been turned down for a loan at Palmetto State Bank?
My knowledge, they have not.
Now, there were some loans that were, I guess, written off, as you said, or charged off, where Alec was a member of a partnership, LLC, some sort of structure where there were other partners involved, and that those loans went in default. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
But Alec kept paying on those notes, did he not?
Periodically, he'd make payments.
Did any of the other partners in Redbeard or United, were they making payments?
To my knowledge, no.
To your knowledge, it was only Alec that was making the payments?
Yes.
To your knowledge, was there any reason in the world for Alec to believe that in June of 2021, if he needed additional money from Palmetto State Bank, that he couldn't just go down there and talk to Russell Lafitte or Charlie Lafitte and ask for a loan?
In June of 2021?
Yes, sir.
I don't see any reason why he couldn't have that conversation with Charlie and Russell.
And he had, to your knowledge, never put on any notice that your business is not welcome here at Palmetto State Bank in June of 2021. Is that right?
In June of 2021, that's correct.
In June of 2021, the bank is fully collateralized on the outstanding notes.
With the exception of the one where he was a co-borrower, I believe, with his father. I think that was an unsecured loan.
And his father being Randolph Murdoch.
The third, yes, sir.
The third, yes, sir. One second, Your Honor. Further questions here.
Redirect.
Very briefly, Your Honor. You're asking about whether Alec made some year-end payments on some of those charged-off loans, correct?
Yes, sir.
And your review was some of that money that was used to make those payments ultimately converted money from client funds?
I believe so, yes.
You're asked whether or not in June of 2021, whether Alec could have talked to Charlie Lafitte or Russell Lafitte about another loan. Is that right?
In June of 2021, yes.
In June of 2021. At that point in time, had it come out that he had been stealing client funds for years?
No, sir.
Had it come out that he had been disbarred?
No, sir.
Had it come out that he had been diverting fees from his law firm?
No, sir.
Had it come out that he had been forced to resign from his law firm?
No, sir.
If any other things had come out, would the bank continue to have loaned him money?
No, sir.
Mr. Griffin asked you if Alec had been a good customer, correct?
Yes, sir.
When all of this crashed and burned, was the bank left holding the bag for all these uncollected loans?
Yes, sir.
Including the $750,000?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Malinowski, the bank had mortgages on the properties that we just went over, did it not?
They did.
And those mortgages didn't disappear when Alec Murdoch, when all this came to light, did they?
No, sir.
All right. Thank you.
I'm going to step down.
Thank you.
Let me call your next witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. State calls Mark Tinsley.
Your right hand and the finger on the Bible. Do you affirm the testimony about the guilt of this court in this trial shall be the truth? So help you God.
I do.
Thank you. Take a seat in the witness stand. State your name again for the record. Spell your last name, please.
Afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Mark Tinsley, T-I-N-S-L-E-Y.
Mr. Tinsley, how are you doing today?
Good.
Introduce yourself to the jury a little bit. Please tell them a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, and a little bit about your profession, please.
Sure. I said my name's Mark Tinsley. I'm a lawyer. I practice in Allendale. I've been there since about 2000. I'm originally from...
Mr. Tinsley, get that mic a little bit closer to you.
Well, the mic's short, and my knees apparently are long because this is the most uncomfortable place to sit.
You can bend it down a little bit, maybe.
I'm from Anderson originally. I went to Clemson. I carried an orange book bag when I was at Carolina. I went to law school there. I graduated in 98. I worked in Columbia for a couple of years doing primarily insurance defense work. You've heard a lot of plaintiff's lawyers. So I would have been one of the lawyers representing an insurance company that was hired to or had the coverage on somebody who was getting sued. Or I would have dealt with coverage. Is a specific loss covered or something? So that's primarily what I did for the first 2 years. One of my good friends was originally from Barnwell. I made my way to Allendale in 2000, and I've been there ever since.
And so since Barnwell, have you been in a law firm? You've been in practice? Tell us a little more about that.
I have. I practice with Gooding and Gooding. You know, when you live in a small town, you do all kinds of things. I have the luxury of having a successful practice and being able to go to different places and handle cases. I try cases. I try truck wrecks. I try highway defect cases where there's something wrong with the way that the contractor had not really designed the road, but maintained the road, and somebody gets catastrophically injured. I've tried bad faith cases where an insurance company has coverage, but for some reason or another, they don't do what they were supposed to do under the contract, and their insured gets harmed as a result or suffers a loss. And so, you know, I pick and choose, but when you're in a small town, you help people. And so I end up doing all kinds of things. There's no case that's too small, no case that's too big. If I can help you, I try to help you.
All right. Over the years, being a lawyer doing this kind of work in this area, have you had call to get to know the lawyers in what used to be known as PMPD?
I have. You know, there's only 17 miles basically between Allendale and Hampton. Small bars. At one time, I think there were really only four, maybe five lawyers in Allendale, and about twice, maybe it ultimately gets up to three or four times that many in Hampton, but it's a small bar. And I had occasion to work with you. You saw Ronnie Crosby, I think, yesterday. I've handled a number of cases with Ronnie Crosby. You've heard Lee Cope's name mentioned. I've had cases with Lee Cope. But I knew everybody.
All right. And did that include the defendant, Alec Murdoch?
It does.
And how long have you known him?
You know, it's hard. I heard Chris Wilson this morning. I don't remember exactly. I came in 2000. I always remember him being there, so sometime shortly after I came to practice in the 14th Circuit.
And do you see him in the courtroom here today?
Sure. He's immediately to the right of Mr. Harpootlian.
Can the record reflect he's identified the defendant? Over the years, as you knew Alec Murdoch, did you ever do anything professionally, either with him or against him?
You know, I hate to be a lawyer, Mr. Waters. I had a case where a defendant was in default and Alec was a special referee, meaning you may remember Chris Wilson said in that Mack truck case, one of the defendants didn't answer. And so if you get sued and you don't respond at the right time, then you're in default. And so the other side by default wins. Generally, and Alec was my special referee, meaning this guy had been accused of selling some property under lien. He was arrested at his job, and we sued a company called Southern Finance that incidentally went into bankruptcy. It's a long, complicated story, but we got reversed, and so I didn't do that again.
Just generally, have you had? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I didn't handle cases with Alec. I didn't, not unlike. Say Ronnie or Lee Cope, and We just didn't have that sort of relationship. I guess he and I did so much of the same thing. I don't recall a time over the last 20 years where we worked on a case together.
Being a small bar and doing the same kind of thing, though, y'all are generally familiar with one another and the type of cases y'all were handling and that sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a small bar, and you go to the roster meetings. You know what everybody's doing. You see what cases they have. Yeah, absolutely. You know if they have a success, a big case, or a failure.
You ever been in court when Alec was doing a closing argument?
Yes, probably a couple of times. He tried a case in Allendale. It was the first case, I think it was 98, that the Allendale courthouse burned. The story was that Judge Peoples from Barnwell was going to sentence some guy for a drug offense, and Judge Peoples was very strict on drug offenses, and so the guys who were going to be sentenced on Monday decided Sunday would be a good day to burn the courthouse. So they burned the courthouse, and so many months later, I think Judge Peoples ended up sentencing them. At any rate, they rebuilt the courthouse, and so the first case that was tried in 2005, Alec tried, and I was there when he made his closing argument.
You were present when he did the closing on that?
I was.
Did he get emotional during that closing?
He cried.
Relevance?
No response.
Your Honor, I think this is just relevant to the defendant and his practice as a lawyer, background information, and I think there's been a lot put in issue about the defense about that as well, and I think this is a fair from this witness.
We're in the year 2000.
What year? 2005. It was March of 2005. It was.
Sustained objection.
Let me ask you just a little bit about, though, being in this kind of type of work in a sort of small bar in a small area. You said y'all are generally familiar with what each other are doing to do similar work?
I think so.
All right. And when you're, are there any sort of documentation at the court, jury rosters, anything like that, or rosters that you can pay attention to and have an idea of what each other's doing?
Well, I mean, it is a roster. It is a list of cases. Generally, a case comes up for trial, not in civil cases I'm talking about, supposed to be about a year old. It's usually longer than that, but they go on this list. And so come Monday morning, all the lawyers would show up. There's 100 cases, and so you see what's coming up, who has what cases. And in Hampton in particular, Alec usually had, seemed like, a majority of the cases on the Hampton roster. His name would be on them anyway.
And being a small bar and being, part of that, kind of doing the similar work, is it not uncommon for you to have some knowledge of some of those cases and for others to have knowledge of the cases you're working on?
Sure. Lawyers are the biggest gossips in the world. I mean, everybody knew what everybody was doing.
If you see a case that's on there and then it gets removed or disappears, does that indicate anything to you?
No. I mean, it indicates they were settled. But oftentimes, when you go through the roster, there's actually a notation. The case is settled. The judge will sign what's called a form order, which just administratively disposes of it, takes it off the roster so that it doesn't stay on that list.
And being as part of that small bar, and this is the kind of work you do, that's something you generally pay attention to, as other lawyers part of that area do as well.
Well, it's a lot like sitting in here. I mean, it's easier to pay attention than to just sit there bored. So, yeah, you pay attention to it.
Are you familiar with what's been known as the boat case?
I am very familiar. I represent the Beach family. So I filed the boat case.
And you say the Beach family, are you talking about the family of Mallory Beach?
The family of Mallory Beach, that's right.
And is she the young woman who died in the boat accident?
She did.
And what was the date of that accident?
It was the early morning hours of February 24th, 2019.
At some point, you said you were representing the Beach family. At some point you were approached by the Beach family?
I was shortly after the wreck. There was an incident on the causeway. So this boat crash happens. There's a bridge called, you go over Archer's Creek. Archer's Creek is a creek that separates Parris Island, the marine installation, from, I guess that's Port Royal. And the boat crash happened at that bridge. There's a road, if you can imagine the causeway, there's an old road that goes down to the base of the bridge. And after the boat crash, the law enforcement had cordoned off, had a rope up or yellow flag, yellow taping up. And so Miss Beach wanted to go down to see where her daughter had died. And she wasn't allowed to.
Objection. Relevance. Closure.
Objection is overruled.
Please continue.
She wasn't allowed to go down to the bridge. She was not. She was told it was a crime scene, and she couldn't go down there.
All right. What else did she, and when she was hiring you, what else did she report?
Almost immediately thereafter.
You're saying?
For the truth of the matter, asserted the effect on the listener and the reasons for the actions he took, which has become relevant in the boat case.
You only argue when requested by the court.
My apologies.
Objection overruled.
Almost immediately thereafter, a car pulled up driven by Alex's father. His wife was in the front seat. Alex's wife, Maggie, was in the front seat. They were waved down to the bridge, and that caused her a great amount of distress.
Did she ultimately hire you to represent her?
That day I got involved.
At some point, as you get involved, do you start to investigate the occurrence?
I started to investigate, but I started to try to put pressure on law enforcement, which is, you know, I'm drawing a distinction there almost immediately, because the concern was that it was going to get covered up by the Beach family, and they didn't want that to happen.
Your Honor, I'd object to these references to covering up. It's not relevant to the motive purpose for this testimony, and it is prejudicial under 403.
I sustain the objection.
Strike the previous response. The
objection is sustained. You may proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. Just generally, you investigate the case, is that
I
correct?
Did. Okay.
And at some point, did you reach out or have any discussions with anyone who was representing the defendant, Alec Murdoch?
I did. I've talked to a number of the partners, but after
when
I
you
began,
say partners, you're talking about PMP,
didn't yeah, yes, I'm sorry.
All right.
But eventually I came to know that Danny Henderson was appointed as Alec's personal counsel, who was one of the partners. You may remember there was a video from Alec in the front seat of the law enforcement car and the arm that reaches up and squeezes his shoulder while he's crying. That's Danny Henderson.
All right. And did you and Danny Henderson, did he have any documents for you to review?
He brought me all of the insurance policies for all of the insurance that Alec had in place at the time of the boat crash.
And for what reason did he bring you those documents?
Well, when you do what I do, we can't turn back the hands, we can't undo what's happened. And so, you know, the best that you can hope, and when you get a case like this, this kind of loss, nobody gets what their case is worth, if that means anything. I mean, nobody would willingly trade place with these people for money. But that's all that you can do in a civil case is recover money. And so some things are covered by insurance, some things are not. And so many times when we are drafting lawsuits, we want to know what insurance there was so that we try not to destroy the ability for the insurance to apply in the beginning. So that would have been the reason I was looking at the insurance.
His attorney, Danny Henderson, brought the defendant's policies to you to review. Is that correct?
It seems like it was a week, 10 days after the boat crash.
All right. And did you review those?
I did.
And what if anything, did you find in those documents?
It did not appear to me that he had any coverage other than there was a policy with Progressive, a watercraft policy that applied to the boat. It was $500,000, and it was offered by Progressive immediately. When you have a catastrophic loss, it's not unusual that an insurance company will say, here's our money, take it, please. Because they have an obligation to protect their insured if they can. The other policies that he had didn't provide coverage except for a for-hire hunting operation, which this didn't arise out of. And
what company was that with?
Philadelphia Insurance.
All right. And again, that policy was limited to what?
The occurrence, the accident, if you will, had to arise out of a hunting operation, a business operation. And even if there were some way to say that this boat ride this night did that, there were very specific watercraft exclusions that then excluded the coverage. So accidents are covered, but then you have all these exclusions that take the coverage away, and so there was no coverage.
Did the defendant have an umbrella policy? First, tell the jury what an umbrella policy is very quickly, if you could.
An umbrella policy would be, if you have a primary policy, say on your car, the umbrella policy would sort of be a coverage. It could be broader than your car. It could also apply to your house. Generally, that coverage is, the limits are multiples of maybe what your liability limits are, and it could be broader than just your house. It could apply to your house and your car. So. I don't remember. I think all of the coverage was with Philadelphia, and I remember reviewing all the policies. I don't remember if it was exactly what they were referred to this time.
Did you ever find out if the defendant had an umbrella policy or the status of that policy?
There was no coverage for this boat crash other than with Progressive on the boat.
Did the defendant have an umbrella policy at one time to your review?
He had coverage. He had the coverage with Lloyd's of London and Nautilus immediately before, which was the coverage that was in effect when Gloria Satterfield fell at his house. And he had an umbrella policy there.
All right. And what happened to that policy, that coverage?
The policy came up for renewal. You know, normally they're a year. It comes up for renewal, and this claim's still open. And so when it came up for renewal, the insurance company wouldn't renew the policy, and they canceled it, which is why he then went and bought this hunting club operation or hunting for hire operation, whatever that policy was, but didn't really cover anything because he didn't have that kind of business.
In your assessment and judgment, would that Philadelphia Hunting Lodge policy provide any coverage for the boating accident?
It did not. I told Danny Henderson in November of 2019 that it did not. Philadelphia filed something called a declaratory judgment action where they go and ask the court to declare their rights, meaning we don't have any coverage. It's clear the policy doesn't apply. Judge, tell, in this case, the plaintiff, because they sued us, the Beach family, and they sued Alex Murdoch for a declaration there was no coverage. I refused to participate. I said I would just be bound by whatever the result was because I knew what the result was going to be.
Generally, at this point in time, what was your assessment of the defendant, how lucrative the defendant's practice was and his general wealth?
Well, so I believe that he was making lots of money. I told you that he had most of the cases. So if that's 50% or 60% of the cases that are actively resolving, he's actively making money. Money's coming in. Now, whether I knew that how the law firm worked in terms of they would get their money at the end of the year, that's not uncommon, but it doesn't really change the fact that he's making lots of money. And that didn't really change in the time that I knew him. It certainly hadn't changed in the years immediately preceding the boat crash, so the last 3 to 5 years.
All right. And ultimately, with your review of the insurance coverages the only one that you thought was applicable was which one?
The progressive boat policy.
And how much was that?
$500,000.
And from your assessment of the case, was that going to be enough?
No, it wasn't. There were six people on the boat, including Alex's son, Paul. So there was one girl whose hand was pretty severely injured. She had about $130,000 in medical bills, a couple of surgeries. You had one boy who was thrown into the console and had a broken jaw.
Object to this, 401, 403.
And opinion.
Objections overruled.
And his medical bills exceeded $100,000. So, you know, you got a death, you got two people with substantial medical bills, and there was just no way there was enough coverage at $500,000.
As a result of that assessment and your assessment of the defendant's lucrative practice and wealth, what, if any, goals did you develop for this particular litigation?
I don't know if it's as easy to answer that, but as I began to realize there was no coverage, it was clear that and oftentimes when you have someone who is very affluent, who has a lot of money, it's not uncommon for those people to pay in addition to what they have in insurance. And so Ellick was going to have to pay out of his own pocket to settle the cases.
Did you ultimately file suit in this matter?
I filed suit, I think, about a month after the boat crash. I filed suit before the criminal charges were brought.
Criminal charges against who?
Paul, I'm sorry.
And so in March of 2019? You filed suit?
I believe so.
And did you sue the defendant?
I did.
All right. Without getting into the weeds too much, what's the basis of potential liability for the defendant?
So, in the very beginning, if there was any chance at coverage, the allegations were that he knew that his son Buster, his older son Buster, who was 21 years old, had obtained a duplicate license, and that Paul was using that license to buy alcohol. And so it's sort of Ellick's lawyers from time to time have characterized it as negligent parenting, but it's in the law you have this idea that there's this thing called negligent entrustment. You know that somebody drinks, you know that he has a propensity to drink in excess, get drunk. You give him your vehicle, you've created a hazardous situation. And so that's the liability against Ellick. And so what I did in the very beginning, in the first lawsuit, was I drafted it to try to see if there could be coverage, even though I didn't think it was going to be successful.
You testified that you'd made the assessment that the defendant was going to have to personally pay in this matter, correct?
He was.
Did you ultimately communicate that to his attorneys and to the defense in this case?
Multiple times and very clearly.
And in this case, I mean the boat case.
Yes.
Is there such a concept as a friendly defendant or a venue defendant or a placeholder defendant in civil litigation?
There is.
Can you just very quickly explain that to the jury?
It started, you first see the references back in, I think it was the 40s and 50s, and it was a way that if you're from out of state and you get sued in South Carolina, you have a right, rather than be in state court like we are now, you could have it, that case against you taken to federal court. And so oftentimes what people would do to keep the out-of-state person from taking it to federal court and rather keep it in the county where they knew everybody is you would also sue someone in state. And so that was it was a venue defendant. Now, and that kept the federal court from having what's called diversity. But in civil cases in state court, Sometimes you do that. I mean, if there are two people driving a car, driving two cars, two people involved in the wreck, you know, the passenger didn't cause the wreck. So you could sue both and let the jury sort out who it was, even though you believe that probably 99% of the liability is on one person, or maybe all of it's on one person. Juries do crazy things sometimes.
Had you made it clear to the defense during this time that you were not considering the defendant just a friendly defendant or a placeholder defendant or a venue defendant?
From the beginning and very clearly.
And that meant you were seeking a personal recovery against him?
He was always going to have to pay, and pay a lot of money.
Does your area of the law, do y'all have some sort of annual conference every year that many people involved in it attend?
We do. Michael Gunn mentioned it. I think he called it SCADJ or SCAD. I don't know. So I called it the Trial Lawyers Conference. It was at the Westin at Hilton Head every year.
And what time of year does that, what month does that take
place? It's usually the first weekend of August. So that if that's first, second, third, or fourth, fifth, and sixth, but it's usually that first week of August.
In August of 2019, did you attend that conference?
I did.
And did you see the defendant there?
I did.
And did you have any conversation with him?
Normally, different law firms have dinners, and groups of lawyers, it's because it's marketing too, right? I mean, you go and you have dinners and you take other lawyers out who may send you cases or get you involved in cases. And so after dinner, everybody sort of comes back to the hotel, and there at the Westin, there's a gathering area. And I think it was a fundraiser, either for Mr. Harpootlian or for Lindsey Graham. But there were a whole room of lawyers, and he saw me. And this is the first sort of gathering. There's a little tension, I think, generally in the room about it. And then he beelines across the room and gets about this close.
And what does the defendant say to you?
Hey, Bo, what's this I've been hearing about what you've been saying? I thought we were friends.
And did you respond to that?
I did. I told him that we were friends, that if he didn't think that I was going to do everything I needed to do to help my clients, he was wrong, and he needed to settle the case.
Was that conversation about your intent to seek a personal recovery?
That's when he said, what's this about what I've been hearing? I thought we were friends. That's what he was talking about. He didn't like the fact that I was saying he was going to have to come out of his pocket and pay.
Moving on to the following month, was there a mediation in the case?
The next year. So that was August of 19. We don't have the mediation until September of 20.
At this point in time, the case has been filed, and without getting to detail, you're generally engaging in the discovery process. Is that correct?
We are, which is you go and you put witnesses under oath, and you take their depositions and you examine them and you collect documents and those sorts of things. But we were taking depositions, primarily of law enforcement, the people at the emergency room, that sort of thing.
What happened in March of 2020 that affected everybody?
Well, COVID began to shut the courts down. We continued to take some depositions, but ultimately, I think it was probably April, May, then we were sort of confined to our offices by then. So in March, we're still taking depositions of law enforcement, and it sort of slows down.
You continue to work on the boat case?
We did.
Continue to gather evidence and documentation?
I did. There was a number of things that we knew existed that had not been collected by law enforcement and didn't appear to exist as far as law enforcement were concerned. And so, you know, for instance, I subpoenaed from the Department of Defense, I believe, and ultimately got all of the federal government's documents of affidavits and things of witnesses that were out there from Parris Island.
And without getting into all the details of the evidence, were you gathering evidence that you felt made your claim against the defendant strong?
It did.
And did you share some of these findings, at least some of these findings, with the defense?
Well, you know, they're sitting in the room. I mean, they might not know it until I bring it out. You know, the first lawyer asks questions, and then the person may or may not be completely truthful, and then you bring out the document. And so they're seeing it happen. And that's mainly with law enforcement. There were a number of law enforcement depositions where that happened.
As you're moving through the months of COVID and their shutdown and everything like that, is one of the things that you do is use a mock jury to sort of assess your case.
Objection, Your Honor. 401-403.
Objection's overruled.
I did in this case.
All right. And some of this evidence that you felt was strong, did you sort of present that to this mock jury? It is just as a tool to help you assess how strong your case is and how likelihood it is of a recovery.
Yes, and I was specifically interested in Beaufort County, and I can explain that if you want.
Just very briefly, let's try not to get into the weeds too much, but just, yeah, if you can.
So the alcohol was sold by a convenience store, Parker's convenience store. And the Parker's lawyer at times would seem to act like Paul wasn't the driver, and at other times,
the objection's overruled.
At other times, he would go after law enforcement, specifically about that particular officer's connection with Alex Murdoch or the Murdochs in general, and so. You really can't have it both ways, right? I mean, if Paul's not the driver, you don't really worry about the alcohol that was sold, then the connection with law enforcement sort of becomes irrelevant. So and it was clear what they were doing was they were trying to try a case that look at all the bad things, don't let him get away with this because of verdict against Parker's. And so I was interested in if we went to Beaufort, because I'm being told by Alex's lawyer that a Hampton jury won't return a verdict against him. And so what I'm trying to determine is, if we go to Beaufort, is the evidence that I have uncovered so overwhelming that a jury ignores the clear breaches by Parker's company?
And ultimately, again, without getting into the weeds, were the results of that exercise with the mock jury, did that give you further confidence in the strength of a large recovery against the defendant? Just answer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And ultimately, did you communicate that to the defendant's defense team?
I did. I also to Ronnie Crosby, who said that he would talk to Alec, and then they wanted copies of some of the statements by the people that wanted to take everything he had.
What time period are we talking about?
Right. This was May of 20.
Did you have anything else going on in your life as this time period was going as well?
Well, I was getting divorced.
Right. That's significant.
Yeah. But yeah, so.
All right.
But yeah, I think you're later in the summer, but.
I got you. As we move from May of 2020 into the fall of 2020, are those conversations continuing with the defense about the strength of your case and your desire to have a personal recovery against the defendant?
Sure, there was a lot of pushback about the shock that I would hold Alec personally responsible, make him pay. And then in August of 20, I figured out that I had cancer, and But we continued to work. And then probably by November, I knew how bad it was. And I knew that I was going to be gone. And so I tried to make arrangements to do things, because I'm still having to decide. The case is getting some age on it. We filed it pretty soon. A case that gets about a year old ought to go on the trial roster. We have mandatory mediation. We're going to mediate it in September. And then immediately after that, it would be eligible for trial. We didn't settle the case. And in November, I sent some requests to admit, which is in the law, in civil cases, there's all this evidence. It's like in here, you've seen this. You have to bring somebody in here that says, I opened the car door, and then you bring the next guy in and says, well, I took the mats out. And if that's not disputed, then we can send something, it's a written question, say, admit that it was daylight when this happened. Okay, we'll admit that. So we don't have to call somebody in. And so it's admit certain facts to be true, and then those things are taken as true, and we don't have to present them. So I had made up my mind that I was going to send the case to Buford after the focus groups, and I was going to try the case in Buford. So I sent requests to admit in November of 19 before I was about to leave to go to Florida for my cancer treatment.
In November of 19?
I'm sorry, November of 20. I think it was November the 19th.
But. All right, before we get there, you'd had some discussions with the defense about the strength of your case, as you've talked about, correct?
Oh, yeah.
And the strength of your case against the defendant, is that correct?
Yeah, and one
just
of the
real quick,
other...
let me ask a question, if you could.
Sure.
Had you had any discussions about a number that you were seeking from the defendant, roughly?
I ultimately, I have that conversation. They pushed me for a number. By November, I've given them a number, yes.
All right. And roughly what that number was?
That number, he was going to have to pay $10 million out of his pocket.
And did the defense have any response to you eventually?
That he might could cobble together $1 million.
Did they have any other response?
He was broke.
He was broke. He could only get $1 million.
Maybe could get $1 million.
Based on your knowledge of the defendant and his practice as you've testified, did you accept that response that he was, quote, broke, unquote?
No, I didn't believe it at all.
Did you offer him any other sort of settlement, any sort of type of plan or anything like that?
If you're broke, I'm happy to work out a payment plan. You can make payments. You can convey Moselle. I knew he had Moselle. He got Moselle right after a big settlement in 2012. So that's 1,700 acres, conveyed Moselle, convey the beach house. He still had the house in Hampton. And we'll work out a payment plan on the rest.
Did they reject that?
He did.
Having been told that the defendant is broke, despite what you believe, did you have a response to them?
I did. In October, almost immediately after the mediation, I served some discovery. Again, it's a written question, and there are two different types. There's interrogatories where you ask a question, tell me where you bank. And then there could be requests for production, give me your bank records. Now, I didn't say that, but I did. I sent discovery to...
And just real quick, we'll talk about discovery in a second, but generally, what is that response? He says I'm broke. What are you saying in response?
There's no way. I mean, he has a spigot of money that's running. He's settling cases. He's got big cases. He's got lots of cases. He's got generational wealth. There's no way he's got 1,800 acres in Moselle. He's not broke by anybody's standards.
Did you ask the defense to, okay, show me the books, prove to me that you're broke?
I did.
And what was the response?
No.
So that led you to some discovery?
It led me to send discovery to get that information.
And specifically, what information as it relates to the defendant's books and the defendant's accounts are you talking about?
Well, it was broad, so it was broader than this, but what I was looking for was the institutions, the accounts, where he did his banking. Because if he was, in fact, broke, if his bank account says zero or $5,000 or $7,000, it was because he was doing, he was hiding it, in my opinion, at the time. So that's what I was looking for.
All right. And so you sent those discovery requests?
I did.
And did the defendant provide that information, or did they decline to provide that information?
They objected almost immediately.
And so did you then file some subsequent legal papers because they refused to provide the information about the defendant's accounts?
I did. I filed what's called a motion to compel, where I asked the judge to compel or make him give me the information.
Show you what's been marked as State's Exhibit 402, and just generally just see if you recognize this document. If you flip through it real quick.
I do. It's the motion to compel that I filed with three exhibits, which are his lawyer's responses, the objections to the questions.
All right. And what's the date on that document? The motion to compel.
The motion to compel was filed October the 16th, 2020.
Your Honor, this time I would offer State's Exhibit 402 in evidence, I believe, subject only to a previous objection.
No additional objections, Your Honor.
It's admitted.
All right, get out of the screen over there, please. All right, this is State's 402, the one you just described, is that right?
That's right.
And that's the date on it right there?
Correct.
And I've turned over what's Exhibit B to this document. And is this some of that discovery asking for the defendant to identify his specific bank accounts that you were just describing?
That's right.
And can you just read number one right there? That's a question that you're asking the defendant to provide to you, correct?
Yeah. What you see there is the answer is, so this is Alex's lawyer has retyped the questions that I sent. So that's the question that I wrote. Number one, list all checking and or savings accounts, including credit union accounts, certificates of deposit, 401k accounts, SEP accounts, IRAs maintained by you individually and or jointly with any others, and any other accounts over which you had signature authority in any capacity, regardless of whether or not the account or accounts have been closed from February 2019 to present. And then the answer is what his lawyer said, which is generally an objection. It's overbroad, it's unduly burdensome, it's not relevant, doesn't have anything to do with it. So
they had objected and you filed a motion to compel. And again, without too much detail, is a motion to compel to ask the judge in the civil case to force them to provide you this information?
That's right.
And if that motion, and we'll talk more about this in a minute, but if a motion to compel is successful and you had gotten the defendant to produce the identity of all accounts he had, what would have been your next step if you continued to follow that threat?
Well, so I knew some information. I would have verified that he was telling me the truth, right? So some things I'm verifying, but I would have ultimately sent subpoenas to the banks. And then I would have begun to subpoena the accounts. I mean, I know he's got a personal account. I know that the law firm's got accounts, but he's got these other entities, these partnerships and things. I didn't know if he had accounts there. So that would have been what would have happened next.
At this point in time, were you aware of any institutions that you believe the defendant had bank accounts at?
I knew about Palmetto State Bank, and I believe that I knew about Bank of America.
At this point in time, though, did you have any idea about all the stuff over there with the fake forge account and all this other stuff that the jury's heard about?
Not a clue.
But had you been successful, you would have sought to identify all accounts in his name and then reviewed those accounts. Is that correct?
Yeah, the subpoena to Bank of America wouldn't have said, give me the information for account 102 or whatever the number was, it would have been for all accounts that have his name on it, period, in any capacity. So it would have been very broad.
And to be fair, they could continue to object to subpoenas and that sort of thing, but this was, if you had to follow this thread, that was the tack that you were taking by filing this document. Is that correct?
That's exactly what it was, and I was doing it like you heard Chris Wilson talk about in that Mack Truck case, that the defendant didn't want this to happen. Well, this is normal in a civil case. There's lots of times that defendants don't want certain things to happen, and so if they don't want it, that's what I want. And so I'm putting pressure where I can put pressure, and this is a place that I can put pressure. At the time, I think it's because he's making so much money, he doesn't really want us to know how much money he's making.
That's that motion's filed in October of 2020. Is there any hearing on that scheduled right away, or does that take sometimes a while for that kind of thing to happen?
It took a while. You know, COVID wasn't over, but the courts weren't really running. There were some courts when the Chief Justice began to open the court system back up. They had to have some kind of COVID plan in place. Hampton wasn't one of them. This case had been specially assigned to a judge from Lancaster. And so there weren't any real opportunities to get the motion heard at that time.
You had initially described how you were, initially, what county did you file this lawsuit in?
I first filed the lawsuit in its first draft in Beaufort County.
Okay. And as we're moving to this time period, COVID slowed things around, you filed your motion to compel. Are you considering moving that to a different county?
By November, I've pretty well made up my mind that I'm gonna move it back to Beaufort County. And it's not just that I'm moving it back, it's that Parker's also had a motion, so I could consent to its motion to move the case back.
And so you're considering putting it in Beaufort at this point, is that right?
That's right.
And was that in part because the defense, or the defendant over there, believed that you couldn't get a verdict against him in Hampton County?
He was insistent.
As we move into early 2021, again, I don't want to get in for purposes of this trial for the specific discussion as it relates to other defendants, but had you start to reassess the decision to maybe take it to Beaufort County?
Yes, while I was in Florida beginning in January, Mr. Parker, who owned Parker's Convenience Store, began to do a number of things that I thought would weigh against me going to Beaufort County.
Yeah. And so did you communicate perhaps moving it or keeping it in Hampton County or moving it to Hampton County?
Not until I got back from my treatment in mid-April.
All right. Stand by for me real quick. Let me ask you this. You said you'd started considering moving it back to Hampton County because of some things that was happening with another defendant, that being the convenience store in Beaufort County, correct?
You said Hampton. I think you meant Beaufort.
Sorry. Let me rephrase that. You're in Beaufort at this point, correct?
No, I'm in Hampton. I filed it initially against Luther's, which was a bar after. So the kids launched a boat from Alec's family place to Chessie, and it's owned by a family trust, Murdoch Family Trust. Maybe there are two properties and there's two trusts. So I sued Alec's father, I sued the trust, because there could have been that alcohol was provided there. Turned out it wasn't. But the kids drank and launched the boat from there. And then they went to an oyster roast. I sued the people who had the oyster roast. From there, they went to a bar called Luther's, where Paul had two shots. And so I sued Luther's, and I sued Ellick. And I'm not 100% certain in that first lawsuit whether I sued Buster or not, but I ultimately did sue Buster.
You were describing you were in April 2021. Had you at that point had some thought process that you communicated to the defense about having the case in Hampton?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And was it because of some of those things with that other defendant that you had mentioned?
So, it was. And the motions were coming up. I mean, it was, you know, I've been gone for 4 months or whatever it is, 4.5 months. And so the motions are set to be heard. And there are a number of motions. Parker's, I said, had filed this motion to transfer the case to Buford before I left.
As you're thinking about, as we're in April of 2021 and you're thinking about putting it in Hampton, you were still concerned, though, about a case against the defendant in Hampton County, his home county, correct?
I think you're still getting Buford and Hampton mixed up, but so not exactly. I was
all right. Well, you explain.
Okay,
to me.
I'll explain. The there were a number of reasons that I wanted the case in Buford. I had substantial evidence. One of the things that we didn't talk about were when you have a 17, 18, 19-year-old girl, which I have, she constantly has her phone and she's constantly taking videos. And so one of the things that I discovered was that Paul's girlfriend had tons of videos. Videos of alcohol, family trips, videos of Paul drinking in front of his parents, videos of him grossly intoxicated. And so that evidence I shared with Ellick's lawyers as well leading up to it. I didn't share it. They didn't serve the same discovery on me because they didn't want the other defendant, Greg Parker's, to have it at that time because they were so entrenched in that there was some sort of venue-friendly lawsuit going on between Ellick and myself, but there wasn't.
Okay. As you're considering all these issues, did you ever convey to the defense any issue about suing any other defendants in Buford County if you felt like your case was not getting a fair shake in Hampton County?
So once I made the decision...
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to stop for the day. We're going to resume at 9:30 tomorrow morning. Please not discuss the case. The nature of the objection.
Your Honor, as I understand this, the relevance of this under the state's theory is financial pressure due to the, he said, $10 million that he expected the defendant to pay. These details about interactions with other defendants, the relevance is just not apparent. And then there's getting...
Your Honor, through my questions, I've been trying to minimize getting into the weeds on that. I believe the response that the witness, I'm happy to proffer an answer to that particular question, is communicating to the defense that he intended to sue Maggie and Paul in Buford County if he detected anything that he thought in Hampton County that was untoward. And I think that that's specifically relevant to the specific pressures that were rising on this defendant April of 2021.
Well, I think you could have asked him that question, but I agree with the defense. You've said you're not trying to get in the weeds, but you're far into the weeds, into the other case, and I sustain the objection.
Yes, sir.
And we will resume at 9:30. Mr. Harpootlian.
Your Honor.
At some point in this case, the defense will have the opportunity to call witnesses.
Yes, sir.
I'm not sure when that's going to be. Anyway, a number of our witnesses, when I say a number, at least four, perhaps five, are from out of state. They're experts. So So it's prohibitively expensive for us to just fly them in and have them sit somewhere for a week or two. I wonder if we could inquire of the state, is there some end to their case that they predict will happen within? And because, Your Honor, if they tell us they're going to end on, I mean, sort of the reverse, they tell us they're going to end on 10 days from today, and they end 8 days from today, or we won't have witnesses to put up. So we delay the court. I've talked to the Attorney General several times, and he has been unable to predict to me when that might happen. I thought perhaps, and I'm not asking he do that right now, but perhaps he could, Your Honor, it would ask him, he could like consult with his team and think about when that might happen. And again, I'm only asking so that we don't say, we don't have a witness here. They're in Chicago or Connecticut or whatever, because they have to book flights and they have to, you know. I'm not whining, I'm just saying to some specific.
Reasonable request, I certainly understand.
I don't hear that much, but thank you.
I believe, and I think the defense counsel will have to concede, I've been very accommodating at what our next day's schedule is and you know, trying to provide that. I've tried my best to communicate with the defense, and I think he would have to concede.
Well, he's not worried about that part. He wants to know, when are you going to be through?
Well, I think I told him, and he says I didn't tell him, and I told him that, you know, right now I'm thinking at the latest midweek next week is what I was thinking. I told him that earlier today. And again, Your Honor understands these are fluid. Objection can happen, cross-examination happens, in-camera proceedings can happen, but that is what I told him.
Does that give you a sufficient idea? You know,
give me an idea. Yeah. But if as this process goes on, they decide they need to, I mean, again, I accused him of gilding the lily and piling on. It's apparently instinctive. I'm not criticizing it. It's his case. I am criticizing it. It's his case. And he has every day when I've asked him, who are you calling tomorrow? Been 100% cooperative. And we're going to do the same for him. But as we proceed through tomorrow, and he thinks he's going to be done midweek, Wednesday of next week.
That's my best assessment right now, yes, sir.
Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to try to structure a plan where we have available witnesses Wednesday, Thursday, that we don't have to fly in, but it may be the following week before we can get those folks here, if that makes some sense. I mean, I
understand. Well, we'll need to address it as we go, and I think maybe reassess things and give you some lead time.
I'm in no way criticizing Mr. Waters. I want to say that. I understand it's a fluid situation. I've been where he is. I spent 12 years as a prosecutor. I know how difficult it is to project these things. Having said that, we've been here a little bit longer than I thought we were going to be. We projected a 3-week trial. We're now 3 weeks, or tomorrow will be 3 weeks. And our case is going to take, we think, at least a week. So if you've rented or set aside hotel rooms for a 3 or 4 week trial, it's probably best to make provisions. And we're going to try to pare that back. We think the jury may not remember what they heard 3 weeks ago, the further we go on.
Okay, we'll just revisit the issue perhaps on a daily basis and see how we're going.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
All right.
That wraps up segment number 5 of continuing coverage in the trial of Alec Murtaugh. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our discussions and continuing coverage on this case. I'm Tony Bruschi. For all of us here at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today, thanks for listening.
What's up, Foos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. Thank you.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
Despiértate, que el $4 breakfast meal deal ha llegado a McDonald's. Incluye un sausage McMuffin o sausage biscuit, hash brown y un café caliente. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu meal deal. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Think about your mentors and idols, the people who inspire you most. While it may look like they have all the answers, they don't. But they do know when to ask questions and seek the support they need. In a world that glorifies hyper-independence, it's easy to forget that we're all better with a support system. Therapy is a great way to find a consistent source of support in your life, so you can break free from the outdated belief that seeking help is a sign of weakness. BetterHelp has experienced therapists ready to help you with challenges, ranging from anxiety and depression to relationships and stress. It's convenient, too. You can join a session with the click of a button, helping you fit therapy into your busy life. And you deserve that. You can even send your therapist a message anytime something comes up. Build your support system with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.